Chapter 4. Why There Almost Certainly Is No God.
The priests of the different religious sects dread the advance of science as witches do the approach of daylight, and scowl on the fatal harbinger announcing the subdivision of the duperies on which they live. Thomas Jefferson.
The ultimate Boeing 747. The argument from improbability is the big one. In the traditional guise of the argument from design, it is easily today's most popular argument offered in favour of the existence of God, and it is seen, by an amazingly large number of theists, as completely and utterly convincing. It is indeed a very strong and, I suspect, unanswerable argument, but in precisely the opposite direction from the theist's intention. The argument from improbability properly deployed comes close to proving that God does not exist. My name for the statistical demonstration that God almost certainly does not exist is the ultimate Boeing 747 gambit. The name comes from Fred Hoyle's amusing image of the Boeing 747 and the scrapyard. Hoyle said that the probability of life originating on Earth is no greater than the chance that a hurricane, sweeping through a scrapyard, would have the luck to assemble a Boeing 747. Others have borrowed the metaphor to refer to the later evolution of complex living bodies, where it has a spurious plausibility. The odds against assembling a fully functioning horse, beetle, or ostrich by randomly shuffling its parts are up there in 747 territory. This, in a nutshell, is the creationist's favourite argument, an argument that could be made only by somebody who doesn't understand the first thing about natural selection, somebody who thinks natural selection is a theory of chance, whereas, in the relevant sense of chance, it is the opposite.
The creationist misappropriation of the argument from improbability always takes the same general form, and it doesn't make any difference if the creationist chooses to masquerade in the politically expedient fancy dress of intelligent design, ID. Some observed phenomenon, often a living creature or one of its more complex organs, but it could be anything from a molecule up to the universe itself, is correctly extolled as statistically improbable. Sometimes the language of information theory is used. The Darwinian is challenged to explain the source of all the information in living matter in the technical sense of information content as a measure of improbability or surprise value. Or the argument may invoke the economist's hackneyed motto, "There's no such thing as a free lunch," and Darwinism is accused of trying to get something for nothing. In fact, as this chapter will show, Darwinian natural selection is the only known solution to the otherwise unanswerable riddle of where the information comes from. It turns out to be the God hypothesis that tries to get something for nothing. God tries to have his free lunch and be it too. However statistically improbable the entity you seek to explain by invoking a designer, the designer himself has got to be at least as improbable. God is the ultimate Boeing 747. A deep understanding of Darwinism teaches us to be wary of the easy assumption that design is the only alternative to chance, and teaches us to seek out graded ramps of slowly increasing complexity. Before Darwin, philosophers, such as Hume, understood that the improbability of life did not mean it had to be designed, but they couldn't imagine the alternative. After Darwin, we all should feel deep in our bones suspicious of the very idea of design. The illusion of design is a trap that has caught us before, and Darwin should have immunized us by raising our consciousness. Would that he had succeeded with all of us. Natural selection as a consciousness raiser. In a science fiction starship, the astronauts were homesick. Just to think that it's springtime back on Earth. You may not immediately see what's wrong with this, so deeply ingrained is the unconscious Northern Hemisphere chauvinism in those of us who live there, and even some who don't. Unconscious is exactly right. That is where consciousness raising comes in. It is for a deeper reason than gimmicky fun that in Australia and New Zealand you can buy maps of the world with the South Pole on top. What splendid consciousness raisers those maps would be, pinned to the walls of our Northern Hemisphere classrooms. Day after day, the children would be reminded that North is an arbitrary polarity which has no monopoly on up. The map would intrigue them as well as raise their consciousness. They'd go home and tell their parents. And by the way, giving children something with which to surprise their parents is one of the greatest gifts a teacher can bestow.
It was the feminists who raised my consciousness to the power of consciousness raising. Her story is obviously ridiculous, if only because the his in history has no etymological connection with the masculine pronoun. It is as etymologically silly as the sacking, in 1999, of a Washington official whose use of niggardly was held to give racial offence. But even daft examples like niggardly or herstory succeed in raising consciousness. Once we've smoothed our philological hackles and stopped laughing, herstory shows us history from a different point of view. Gendered pronouns notoriously are the front line of such consciousness raising. He or she must ask himself or herself whether his or her sense of style could ever allow himself or herself to write like this. But if we can just get over the clunking infelicity of the language, it raises our consciousness to the sensitivities of half the human race. Man, mankind, the rights of man, all men are created equal, one man, one vote. English too often seems to exclude woman. When I was young, it never occurred to me that women might feel slighted by a phrase like the future of man. During the intervening decades, we have all had our consciousness raised. Even those who still use man instead of human do so with an air of self-conscious apology or truculence, taking a stand for traditional language, even deliberately to rile feminists. All participants in the zeitgeist have had their consciousness raised, even those who choose to respond negatively by digging in their heels and redoubling the offence. Feminism shows us the power of consciousness raising, and I want to borrow the technique for natural selection. Natural selection not only explains the whole of life, it also raises our consciousness to the power of science to explain how organised complexity can emerge from simple beginnings without any deliberate guidance. A full understanding of natural selection encourages us to move boldly into other fields. It arouses our suspicion in those other fields of the kind of false alternatives that once, in pre-Darwinian days, beguiled biology. Who before Darwin could have guessed that something so apparently designed as a dragonfly's wing or an eagle's eye was really the end product of a long sequence of non-random but purely natural causes? Douglas Adams's moving and funny account of his own conversion to radical atheism, he insisted on the radical in case anybody should mistake him for an agnostic, is testimony to the power of Darwinism as a consciousness raiser. I hope I shall be forgiven the self-indulgence that will become apparent in the following quotation. My excuse is that Douglas's conversion by my earlier books, which did not set out to convert anyone, inspired me to dedicate to his memory this book, which does. In an interview, reprinted posthumously in The Salmon of Doubt, he was asked by a journalist how he became an atheist. He began his reply by explaining how he became an agnostic, and then proceeded,
"And I thought and thought and thought, but I just didn't have enough to go on, so I didn't really come to any resolution. I was extremely doubtful about the idea of God, but I just didn't know enough about anything to have a good working model of any other explanation for, well, life, the universe and everything, to put in its place. But I kept at it, and I kept reading, and I kept thinking. Sometime around my early 30s, I stumbled upon evolutionary biology, particularly in the form of Richard Dawkins's books, The Selfish Gene and then The Blind Watchmaker, and suddenly, on I think the second reading of The Selfish Gene, it all fell into place. It was a concept of such stunning simplicity, but it gave rise naturally to all of the infinite and baffling complexity of life. The awe it inspired in me made the awe that people talk about in respect of religious experience seem, frankly, silly beside it. I'd take the awe of understanding over the awe of ignorance any day."
The concept of stunning simplicity that he was talking about was, of course, nothing to do with me. It was Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, the ultimate scientific consciousness raiser. Douglas, I miss you. You are my cleverest, funniest, most open-minded, wittiest, tallest, and possibly only convert. I hope this book might have made you laugh, though not as much as you made me. That scientifically savvy philosopher, Daniel Dennett, pointed out that evolution counters one of the oldest ideas we have.
The idea that it takes a big, fancy, smart thing to make a lesser thing. I call that the trickle-down theory of creation. You'll never see a spear making a spear maker. You'll never see a horseshoe making a blacksmith. You'll never see a pot making a potter.
Darwin's discovery of a workable process that does that very counterintuitive thing is what makes his contribution to human thought so revolutionary and so loaded with the power to raise consciousness. Other sciences raise our consciousness in different ways. Fred Hoyle's own science of astronomy puts us in our place, metaphorically as well as literally, scaling down our vanity to fit the tiny stage on which we play out our lives, our speck of debris from the cosmic explosion. Geology reminds us of our brief existence, both as individuals and as a species. It raised John Ruskin's consciousness and provoked his memorable heart cry of 1851.
If only the geologists would let me alone, I could do very well. But those dreadful hammers! I hear the clink of them at the end of every cadence of the Bible verses.
Evolution does the same thing for our sense of time, not surprisingly since it works on the geological timescale. But Darwinian evolution, specifically natural selection, does something more. It shatters the illusion of design within the domain of biology and teaches us to be suspicious of any kind of design hypothesis in physics and cosmology as well. I think the physicist Leonard Susskind had this in mind when he wrote,
"I'm not an historian, but I'll venture an opinion. Modern cosmology really began with Darwin and Wallace. Unlike anyone before them, they provided explanations of our existence that completely rejected supernatural agents. Darwin and Wallace set a standard not only for the life sciences, but for cosmology as well."
I am continually astonished by those theists who, far from having their consciousness raised in the way that I propose, seem to rejoice in natural selection as God's way of achieving his creation. They note that evolution by natural selection would be a very easy and neat way to achieve a world full of life. God wouldn't need to do anything at all. Peter Atkins, in Creation Revisited, takes this line of thought to a sensibly godless conclusion when he postulates a hypothetically lazy God who tries to get away with as little as possible in order to make a universe containing life. Step by step, Atkins succeeds in reducing the amount of work the lazy God has to do until he finally ends up doing nothing at all. He might as well not bother to exist. My memory vividly hears Woody Allen's perceptive whine.
If it turns out there is a God, I don't think he's evil. But the worst that you can say about him is that, basically, he's an underachiever.
Irreducible complexity. It is impossible to exaggerate the magnitude of the problem that Darwin and Wallace solved. I could mention the anatomy, cellular structure, biochemistry and behaviour of literally any living organism by example. But the most striking feats of apparent design are those picked out, for obvious reasons, by creationist authors, and it is with gentle irony that I derive mine from a creationist book. Life, How Did It Get Here? Has no named author but is published by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society in 16 languages and 11 million copies. It is obviously a firm favourite because no fewer than 6 copies have been sent to me as unsolicited gifts by well-wishers from around the world. Picking a page at random from this anonymous and lavishly distributed work, we find the sponge known as Venus's Flower Basket, Euplectella, accompanied by a quotation from Sir David Attenborough, no less.
"When you look at a complex sponge skeleton, such as that made of silica spicules, which is known as Venus's Flower Basket, the imagination is baffled. How could quasi-independent microscopic cells collaborate to secrete a million glassy splinters and construct such an intricate and beautiful lattice? We do not know.
The Watchtower authors lose no time in adding their own punchline.
But one thing we do know, Chance is not the likely designer.
No, indeed, Chance is not the likely designer. That is one thing on which we can all agree. The statistical improbability of phenomena such as Euplectella's skeleton is the central problem that any theory of life must solve. The greater the statistical improbability, the less plausible is chance as a solution. That is what improbable means. But the candidate solutions to the riddle of improbability are not, as is falsely implied, design and chance. They are design and natural selection. Chance is not a solution, given the high levels of improbability we see in living organisms, and no sane biologist ever suggested that it was. Design is not a real solution either, as we shall see later, but for the moment I want to continue demonstrating the problem that any theory of life must solve, the problem of how to escape from chance. Turning Watchtower's page, we find the wonderful plant known as Dutchman's Pipe, Aristolochia trilobata, all of whose parts seem elegantly designed to trap insects, cover them with pollen, and send them on their way to another Dutchman's pipe. The intricate elegance of the flower moves Watchtower to ask,
did all of this happen by chance, or did it happen by intelligent design?
Once again, no, of course it didn't happen by chance. Once again, intelligent design is not the proper alternative to chance. Natural selection is not only a parsimonious, plausible and elegant solution, it is the only workable alternative to chance that has ever been suggested. Intelligent design suffers from exactly the same objection as chance. It is simply not a plausible solution to the riddle of statistical improbability. And the higher the improbability, the more implausible intelligent design becomes. Seen clearly, intelligent design will turn out to be a redoubling of the problem. Turn another Watchtower page for an eloquent account of the giant redwood, Sequoia dendron giganteum, a tree for which I have a special affection because I have one in my garden, a mere baby, scarcely more than a century old, but still the tallest tree in the neighbourhood.
A puny man, standing at a sequoia's base, can only gaze upward in silent awe at its massive grandeur. Does it make sense to believe that the shaping of this majestic giant and of the tiny seed that packages it was not by design?
Yet again, if you think the only alternative to design is chance, then no, it does not make sense. But again, the authors omit all mention of the real alternative, natural selection, either because they genuinely don't understand it, or because they don't want to. The process by which plants, whether tiny pimpernels or massive Wellingtonias, acquire the energy to build themselves is photosynthesis. Watchtower again.
There are about 70 separate chemical reactions involved in photosynthesis, one biologist said. It is truly a miraculous event. Green plants have been called nature's factories, beautiful, quiet, non-polluting, producing oxygen, recycling water and feeding the world. Did they just happen by chance? Is that truly believable?
No, it is not believable, but the repetition of example after example gets us nowhere. Creationist logic is always the same. Some natural phenomenon is too statistically improbable, too complex, too beautiful, too awe-inspiring, to have come into existence by chance. Design is the only alternative to chance that the authors can imagine, therefore a designer must have done it. And science's answer to this faulty logic is also always the same. Design is not the only alternative to chance. Natural selection is a better alternative. Indeed, design is not a real alternative at all, because it raises an even bigger problem than it solves. Who designed the designer? Chance and design both fail as solutions to the problem of statistical improbability, because one of them is the problem and the other one regresses to it. Natural selection is a real solution. It is the only workable solution that has ever been suggested. And it is not only a workable solution, it is a solution of stunning elegance and power. What is it that makes natural selection succeed as a solution to the problem of improbability, where chance and design both fail at the starting gate? The answer is that natural selection is a cumulative process which breaks the problem of improbability up into small pieces. Each of the small pieces is slightly improbable, but not prohibitively so. When large numbers of these slightly improbable events are stacked up in series, the end product of the accumulation is very, very improbable indeed, improbable enough to be far beyond the reach of chance. It is these end products that form the subjects of the creationist's wearisomely recycled argument. The creationist completely misses the point because he, women should for once not mind being excluded by the pronoun, insists on treating the genesis of statistical improbability as a single, one-off event. He doesn't understand the power of accumulation. In Climbing Mount Improbable, I express the point in a parable. One side of the mountain is a sheer cliff, impossible to climb, but on the other side is a gentle slope to the summit. On the summit sits a complex device such as an eye or a bacterial flagella motor. The absurd notion that such complexity could spontaneously self-assemble is symbolized by leaping from the foot of the cliff to the top in one bound. Evolution, by contrast, goes around the back of the mountain and creeps up the gentle slope to the summit. Easy. The principle of climbing the gentle slope, as opposed to leaping up the precipice, is so simple, one is tempted to marvel that it took so long for a Darwin to arrive on the scene and discover it. By the time he did, nearly three centuries had elapsed since Newton's Annus Mirabilis of discovery, although his achievement seems, on the face of it, harder than Darwin's.
Another favourite metaphor for extreme improbability is the combination lock on a bank vault. Theoretically, a bank robber could get lucky and hit upon the right combination of numbers by chance. In practice, the bank's combination lock is designed with enough improbability to make this tantamount to impossible, almost as unlikely as Fred Hoyle's Boeing 747. But imagine a badly designed combination lock that gave out little hints progressively, the equivalent of the getting warmer of children playing Hunt the Slipper. Suppose that when each one of the dials approaches its correct setting, the vault door opens another chink and a dribble of money trickles out. The burglar would home in on the jackpot in no time. Creationists who attempt to deploy the argument from improbability in their favour always assume that biological adaptation is a question of the jackpot or nothing. Another name for the jackpot or nothing fallacy is irreducible complexity, IC. Either the eye sees or it doesn't. Either the wing flies or it doesn't. There are assumed to be no useful intermediates, but this is simply wrong. Such intermediates abound in practice, which is exactly what we should expect in theory. The combination lock of life is a getting warmer, getting cooler, getting warmer, hunt the slipper device. Real life seeks the gentle slopes at the back of Mount Improbable, while creationists are blind to all but the daunting precipice at the front. Darwin devoted an entire chapter of The Origin of Species to difficulties on the theory of descent with modification, and it is fair to say that this brief chapter anticipated and disposed of every single one of the alleged difficulties that have since been proposed right up to the present day. The most formidable difficulties are Darwin's organs of extreme perfection and complication, sometimes erroneously described as irreducibly complex. Darwin singled out the eye as posing a particularly challenging problem.
To suppose that the eye, with all its inimitable contrivances for adjusting the focus to different distances, for admitting different amounts of light, and for the correction of spherical and chromatic aberration, could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree.
Creationists gleefully quote this sentence again and again. Needless to say, they never quote what follows. Darwin's fulsomely free confession turned out to be a rhetorical device. He was drawing his opponents towards him so that his punch, when it came, struck the harder. The punch, of course, was Darwin's effortless explanation of exactly how the eye evolved by gradual degrees. Darwin may not have used the phrase irreducible complexity or the smooth gradient up Mount Improbable, but he clearly understood the principle of both. What is the use of half an eye, and what is the use of half a wing, are both instances of the argument from irreducible complexity. A functioning unit is said to be irreducibly complex if the removal of one of its parts causes the whole to cease functioning. This has been assumed to be self-evident for both eyes and wings, but as soon as we give these assumptions a moment's thought, we immediately see the fallacy. A cataract patient, with the lens of her eye surgically removed, can't see clear images without glasses, but can see enough not to bump into a tree or fall over a cliff. Half a wing is indeed not as good as a whole wing, but it is certainly better than no wing at all. Half a wing could save your life by easing your fall from a tree of a certain height, and 51% of a wing could save you if you fall from a slightly taller tree. Whatever fraction of a wing you have, there is a fall from which it will save your life where a slightly smaller winglet would not. The thought experiment of trees of different height, from which one might fall, is just one way to see, in theory, that there must be a smooth gradient of advantage all the way from 1% of a wing to 100%. The forests are replete with gliding or parachuting animals, illustrating in practice every step of the way up that particular slope of Mount Improbable.
By analogy with the trees of different height, it is easy to imagine situations in which half an eye would save the life of an animal where 49% of an eye would not. Smooth gradients are provided by variations in lighting conditions, variations in the distance at which you catch sight of your prey or your predators. And as with wings and flight surfaces, plausible intermediates are not only easy to imagine, they are abundant all around the animal kingdom. A flatworm has an eye that, by any sensible measure, is less than half a human eye. Nautilus, and perhaps its extinct ammonite cousins, who dominated Paleozoic and Mesozoic seas, has an eye that is intermediate in quality between flatworm and human. Unlike the flatworm eye, which can detect light and shade but see no image, the Nautilus pinhole camera eye makes a real image, but it is a blurred and dim image compared to ours. It would be spurious precision to put numbers on the improvement, but nobody could sanely deny that these invertebrate eyes and many others are all better than no eye at all, and all lie on a continuous and shallow slope up Mount Improbable, with our eyes near a peak, not the highest peak, but a high one. In Climbing Mount Improbable, I devoted a whole chapter each to the eye and the wing, demonstrating how easy it was for them to evolve by slow, or even maybe not all that slow, gradual degrees. And I will leave the subject here.
So, we have seen that eyes and wings are certainly not irreducibly complex. But what is more interesting than these particular examples is the general lesson we should draw. The fact that so many people have been dead wrong over these obvious cases should serve to warn us of other examples that are less obvious, such as the cellular and biochemical cases now being touted by those creationists who shelter under the politically expedient euphemism of intelligent design theorists. We have a cautionary tale here, and it is telling us this. Do not just declare things to be irreducibly complex. The chances are that you haven't looked carefully enough at the details or thought carefully enough about them. On the other hand, we on the science side must not be too dogmatically confident. Maybe there is something out there in nature that really does preclude, by its genuinely irreducible complexity, the smooth gradient of Mount Improbable. The creationists are right that if genuinely irreducible complexity could be properly demonstrated, it would wreck Darwin's theory. Darwin himself said as much.
If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find no such case.
Darwin could find no such case, and nor has anybody since Darwin's time, despite strenuous, indeed desperate efforts. Many candidates for this holy grail of creationism have been proposed. None has stood up to analysis.
In any case, even though genuinely irreducible complexity would wreck Darwin's theory if it were ever found, who is to say that it wouldn't wreck the intelligent design theory as well? Indeed, it already has wrecked the intelligent design theory, for, as I keep saying and will say again, however little we know about God, the one thing we can be sure of is that he would have to be very, very complex, and presumably irreducibly so. The worship of gaps. Searching for particular examples of irreducible complexity is a fundamentally unscientific way to proceed, a special case of arguing from present ignorance. It appeals to the same faulty logic as the God of the Gap strategy condemned by the theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Creationists eagerly seek a gap in present-day knowledge or understanding. If an apparent gap is found, it is assumed that God, by default, must fill it. What worries thoughtful theologians such as Bonhoeffer is that gaps shrink as science advances, and God is threatened with eventually having nothing to do and nowhere to hide. What worries scientists is something else. It is an essential part of the scientific enterprise to admit ignorance, even to exult in ignorance, as a challenge to future conquests. As my friend Matt Ridley has written,
"Most scientists are bored by what they have already discovered. It is ignorance that drives them on."
Mystics exult in mystery and want it to stay mysterious. Scientists exult in mystery for a different reason. It gives them something to do. One of the truly bad effects of religion is that it teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. Admissions of ignorance and temporary mystification are vital to good science. It is therefore unfortunate, to say the least, that the main strategy of creation propagandists is the negative one of seeking out gaps in scientific knowledge and claiming to fill them with intelligent design by default. The following is hypothetical but entirely typical. A creationist speaking.
"The elbow joint of the lesser spotted weasel frog is irreducibly complex. No part of it would do any good at all until the whole was assembled. Bet you can't think of a way in which the weasel frog's elbow could have evolved by slow, gradual degrees."
If the scientist fails to give an immediate and comprehensive answer, the creationist draws a default conclusion.
"Right then, the alternative theory, intelligent design, wins by default."
Notice the biased logic. If theory A fails in some particular, theory B must be right. Needless to say, the argument is not applied the other way around. We are encouraged to leap to the default theory without even looking to see whether it fails in the very same particular as the theory it is alleged to replace. Intelligent design, ID, is granted a get-out-of-jail-free card, a charmed immunity to the rigorous demands made of evolution. But my present point is that the creationist ploy undermines the scientist's natural, indeed necessary, rejoicing in temporary uncertainty. For purely political reasons, today's scientist might hesitate before saying,
"Interesting point. I wonder how the weasel frog's ancestors did evolve their elbow joint. I'm not a specialist in weasel frogs. I'll have to go to the university library and take a look. Might make an interesting project for a graduate student."
The moment a scientist said something like that, and long before the student began the project, the default conclusion would become a headline in a creationist pamphlet.
"Weasel frog could only have been designed by God."
There is then an unfortunate hook-up between science's methodological need to seek out areas of ignorance in order to target research, and ID's need to seek out areas of ignorance in order to claim victory by default. It is precisely the fact that ID has no evidence of its own, but thrives like a weed in gaps left by scientific knowledge, that sits uneasily with science's need to identify and proclaim the very same gaps as a prelude to researching them. In this respect, science finds itself in alliance with sophisticated theologians like Bonhoeffer, united against the common enemies of naive, populist theology and the gap theology of intelligent design. The creationists' love affair with gaps in the fossil record symbolizes their whole gap theology. I once introduced a chapter on the so-called Cambrian explosion with the sentence, "It is as though the fossils were placed there without any evolutionary history." Again, this was a rhetorical overture intended to whet the reader's appetite for the full explanation that was to follow. Sad hindsight tells me now how predictable it was that my patient explanation would be excised, and my overture itself gleefully quoted out of context. Creationists adore gaps in the fossil record, just as they adore gaps generally.
Many evolutionary transitions are elegantly documented by more or less continuous series of gradually changing intermediate fossils. Some are not, and these are the famous gaps. Michael Shermer has wittily pointed out that if a new fossil discovery neatly bisects a gap, the creationist will declare that there are now twice as many gaps. But in any case, note yet again the unwarranted use of a default. If there are no fossils to document a postulated evolutionary transition, the default assumption is that there was no evolutionary transition, therefore God must have intervened. It is utterly illogical to demand complete documentation of every step of any narrative, whether in evolution or any other science. You might as well demand, before convicting somebody of murder, a complete cinematic record of the murderer's every step leading up to the crime, with no missing frames. Only a tiny fraction of corpses fossilise, and we're lucky to have as many intermediate fossils as we do. We could easily have had no fossils at all, and still the evidence for evolution from other sources, such as molecular genetics and geographical distribution, would be overwhelmingly strong. On the other hand, evolution makes the strong prediction that if a single fossil turned up in the wrong geological stratum, the theory would be blown out of the water. When challenged by a zealous Popperian to say how evolution could ever be falsified, J.B.S. Haldane famously growled,
"Fossil rabbits in the Precambrian."
No such anachronistic fossils have ever been authentically found, despite discredited creationist legends of human skulls in the coal measures and human footprints interspersed with dinosaurs. Gaps, by default in the mind of the creationist, are filled by God. The same applies to all apparent precipices on the massif of Mount Improbable, where the graded slope is not immediately obvious or is otherwise overlooked. Areas where there is a lack of data or a lack of understanding are automatically assumed to belong, by default, to God. The speedy resort to a dramatic proclamation of irreducible complexity represents a failure of the imagination. Some biological organ, if not an eye, then a bacterial flagellomotor or a biochemical pathway, is decreed, without further argument, to be irreducibly complex. No attempt is made to demonstrate irreducible complexity. Notwithstanding the cautionary tales of eyes, wings, and many other things, each new candidate for the dubious accolade is assumed to be transparently, self-evidently irreducibly complex, its status asserted by fiat. But think about it. Since irreducible complexity is being deployed as an argument for design, it should no more be asserted by fiat than design itself. You might as well simply assert that the weasel frog, bombardier beetle, etc., demonstrates design without further argument or justification. That is no way to do science.
The logic turns out to be no more convincing than this.
I, insert own name, am personally unable to think of any way in which, insert biological phenomenon, could have been built up step by step. Therefore, it is irreducibly complex. That means it is designed.
Put it like that, and you immediately see that it is vulnerable to some scientist coming along and finding an intermediate, or at least imagining a plausible intermediate. Even if no scientists do come up with an explanation, it is plain bad logic to assume that design will fare any better. The reasoning that underlies intelligent design theory is lazy and defeatist, classic God of the Gaps reasoning. I have previously dubbed it the argument from personal incredulity. Imagine that you are watching a really great magic trick. The celebrated conjuring duo Penn and Teller have a routine in which they simultaneously appear to shoot each other with pistols, and each appears to catch the bullet in his teeth. elaborate precautions are taken to scratch identifying marks on the bullets before they are put in the guns. The whole procedure is witnessed at close range by volunteers from the audience who have experience of firearms, and apparently all possibilities for trickery are eliminated. Teller's marked bullet ends up in Penn's mouth, and Penn's marked bullet ends up in Teller's. I, Richard Dawkins, am utterly unable to think of any way in which this could be a trick. The argument from personal incredulity screams from the depths of my pre-scientific brain centres and almost compels me to say it must be a miracle. There is no scientific explanation. It's got to be supernatural. But the still small voice of scientific education speaks a different message. Penn and Teller are world-class illusionists. There is a perfectly good explanation. It is just that I am too naive or too unobservant or too unimaginative to think of it. That is the proper response to a conjuring trick. It is also the proper response to a biological phenomenon that appears to be irreducibly complex. Those people who leap from personal bafflement at a natural phenomenon straight to a hasty invocation of the supernatural are no better than the fools who see a conjurer bending a spoon and leap to the conclusion that it is paranormal.
Irreducible complexity is not a new idea, but the phrase itself was invented by the creationist Michael Behe in 1996. He is credited, if credited is the word, with moving creationism into a new area of biology, biochemistry and cell biology, which he saw as perhaps a happier hunting ground for gaps than eyes or wings. His best approach to a good example, still a bad one, was the bacterial flagella motor. The flagella motor of bacteria is a prodigy of nature. It drives the only known example, outside human technology, of a freely rotating axle. Wheels for big animals would arguably be genuine examples of irreducible complexity, and this is probably why they don't exist. How would the nerves and blood vessels get across the bearing? The flagellum is a thread-like propeller with which the bacterium propels itself through the water. Unlike the so-called flagellum of larger organisms like protozoans, the bacterial flagellum doesn't just wave about like a whip or row like an oar. It has a true freely rotating axle which turns continuously inside a bearing driven by a remarkable little molecular motor. At the molecular level, the motor uses essentially the same principle as muscle, but in free rotation rather than in intermittent contraction. It has been happily described as a tiny outboard motor, although by engineering standards, and unusually for a biological mechanism, it is a spectacularly inefficient one. Without a word of justification, explanation, or amplification, Behe simply proclaims the bacterial flagella motor to be irreducibly complex. Since he offers no argument in favour of his assertion, we may begin by suspecting a failure of his imagination. He further alleges that specialist biological literature has ignored the problem. The falsehood of this allegation was massively and, to Behe, embarrassingly documented in the court of Judge John E. Jones in Pennsylvania in 2005, where Behe was testifying as an expert witness on behalf of a group of creationists who had tried to impose intelligent design creationism on the science curriculum of a local public school, a move of breathtaking inanity, to quote Judge Jones, phrase and man surely destined for lasting fame. This wasn't the only embarrassment Behe suffered at the hearing, as we shall see.
The key to demonstrating irreducible complexity is to show that none of the parts could have been useful on its own. They all needed to be in place before any of them could do any good. Behe's favourite analogy is a mousetrap. In fact, molecular biologists have no difficulty in finding parts functioning outside the whole, both for the flagella motor and for Behe's other alleged examples of irreducible complexity. The point is well put by Kenneth Miller of Brown University, for my money the most persuasive nemesis of intelligent design, not least because he is a devout Christian. I frequently recommend Miller's book, Finding Darwin's God, to religious people who write to me, having been bamboozled by Behe. In the case of the bacterial rotary engine, Miller calls our attention to a mechanism called the type 3 secretory system, or TTSS. The TTSS is not used for rotatory movement. It is one of several systems used by parasitic bacteria for pumping toxic substances through their cell walls to poison their host organism. On our human scale, we might think of pouring or squirting a liquid through a hole, but once again, on the bacterial scale, things look different. Each molecule of secreted substance is a large protein with a definite three-dimensional structure on the same scale as the TTSS's own, more like a solid sculpture than a liquid. Each molecule is individually propelled through a carefully shaped mechanism, like an automated slot machine dispensing, say, toys or bottles, rather than a simple hole through which a substance might flow. The protein molecules that form the structure of the TTSS are very similar to components of the flagellar motor. To the evolutionist, it is clear that TTSS components were commandeered for a new but not wholly unrelated function when the flagellar motor evolved. Given that the TTSS is tugging molecules through itself, it is not surprising that it uses a rudimentary version of the principle used by the flagellar motor, which tugs the molecules of the axle round and round. Evidently, crucial components of the flagellar motor were already in place and working before the flagellar motor evolved. Commandeering existing mechanisms is an obvious way in which an apparently irreducibly complex piece of apparatus could climb Mount Improbable. A lot more work needs to be done, of course, and I'm sure it will be. Such work would never be done if scientists were satisfied with a lazy default such as intelligent design theory would encourage. Here is the message that an imaginary intelligent design theorist might broadcast to scientists.
If you don't understand how something works, never mind. Just give up and say God did it. You don't know how the nerve impulse works? Good. You don't understand how memories are laid down in the brain? Excellent. Is photosynthesis a bafflingly complex process? Wonderful. Please don't go to work on the problem. Just give up and appeal to God. Dear scientist, don't work on your mysteries. Bring us your mysteries, for we can use them. Don't squander precious ignorance by researching it away. We need those glorious gaps as a last refuge for God.
St. Augustine said it quite openly.
There is another form of temptation, even more fraught with danger. This is the disease of curiosity. It is this which drives us to try and discover the secrets of nature, those secrets which are beyond our understanding, which can avail us nothing, and which man should not wish to learn.
Another of Behe's favourite alleged examples of irreducible complexity is the immune system. Let Judge Jones himself take up the story.
In fact, on cross-examination, Professor Behe was questioned concerning his 1996 claim that science would never find an evolutionary explanation for the immune system. He was presented with 58 peer-reviewed publications, 9 books, and several immunology textbook chapters about the evolution of the immune system. However, he simply insisted that this was still not sufficient evidence of evolution and that it was not good enough.
Behe, under cross-examination by Eric Rothschild, chief counsel for the plaintiffs, was forced to admit that he hadn't read most of those 58 peer-reviewed papers. Hardly surprising, for immunology is hard work. Less forgivable is that Behe dismissed such research as unfruitful. It certainly is unfruitful if your aim is to make propaganda among gullible laypeople and politicians, rather than to discover important truths about the real world. After listening to Behe, Rothschild eloquently summed up what every honest person in that courtroom must have felt.
Thankfully, there are scientists who do search for answers to the question of the origin of the immune system. It's our defence against debilitating and fatal diseases. The scientists who wrote those books and articles toil in obscurity without book royalties or speaking engagements. Their efforts help us combat and cure serious medical conditions. By contrast, Professor Behe and the entire intelligent design movement are doing nothing to advance scientific or medical knowledge and are telling future generations of scientists, don't bother.
In the words of an eloquent blogger,
Why is God considered an explanation for anything? It's not. It's a failure to explain. A shrug of the shoulders and, I don't know, dressed up in spirituality and ritual. If someone credits something to God, generally what it means is that they haven't a clue, so they're attributing it to an unreachable, unknowable sky fairy. Ask for an explanation of where that bloke came from, and odds are you'll get a vague, pseudo-philosophical reply about having always existed or being outside nature, which, of course, explains nothing.
The Anthropic Principle, Planetary Version. Gap theologians who may have given up on eyes and wings, flagella motors and immune systems often pin their remaining hopes on the origin of life. The root of evolution in non-biological chemistry somehow seems to present a bigger gap than any particular transition during subsequent evolution. And in one sense, it is a bigger gap. That one sense is quite specific, and it offers no comfort to the religious apologist. The origin of life only had to happen once. We therefore can allow it to have been an extremely improbable event, many orders of magnitude more improbable than most people realize, as I shall show. Subsequent evolutionary steps are duplicated in more or less similar ways throughout millions and millions of species independently and continually and repeatedly throughout geological time. Therefore, to explain the evolution of complex life, we cannot resort to the same kind of statistical reasoning as we are able to apply to the origin of life. The events that constitute run-of-the-mill evolution, as distinct from its singular origin, and perhaps a few special cases, cannot have been very improbable. This distinction may seem puzzling, and I must explain it further, using the so-called anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is usually applied to the cosmos, and I'll come to that, but I'll introduce the idea on a smaller planetary scale. We exist here on Earth. Therefore, Earth must be the kind of planet that is capable of generating and supporting us, however unusual, even unique, that kind of planet might be. For example, our kind of life cannot survive without liquid water. Indeed, exobiologists searching for evidence of extraterrestrial life are scanning the heavens in practice for signs of water. Around a typical star like our Sun, there is a so-called Goldilocks zone, not too hot and not too cold, but just right, for planets with liquid water. A thin band of orbits lies between those that are too far from the star, where water freezes, and too close, where it boils.
Two main explanations have been offered for our planet's peculiar friendliness to life. The design theory says that God made the world, placed it in the Goldilocks zone, and deliberately set up all the details for our benefit. The anthropic approach is very different, and it has a faintly Darwinian feel. The great majority of planets in the universe are not in the Goldilocks zones of their respective stars, and not suitable for life. None of that majority has life. However small the minority of planets with just the right conditions for life may be, we necessarily have to be on one of that minority, because here we are, thinking about it.
Liquid water is a necessary condition for life as we know it, but it is far from sufficient. Life still has to originate in the water, and the origin of life may have been a highly improbable occurrence. Darwinian evolution proceeds merrily once life has originated, but how does life get started? The origin of life was the chemical event or series of events whereby the vital conditions for natural selection first came about. The major ingredient was heredity, either DNA or, more probably, something that copies like DNA, but less accurately, perhaps the related molecule RNA. Once the vital ingredient, some kind of genetic molecule, is in place, true Darwinian natural selection can follow, and complex life emerges as the eventual consequence. But the spontaneous arising by chance of the first hereditary molecule strikes many as improbable. Maybe it is very, very improbable, and I shall dwell on this, for it is central to this section of the book. The origin of life is a flourishing, if speculative, subject for research. The expertise required for it is chemistry, and it is not mine. I watch from the sidelines with engaged curiosity, and I shall not be surprised if, within the next few years, chemists report that they have successfully midwifed a new origin of life in the laboratory. Nevertheless, it hasn't happened yet, and it is still possible to maintain that the probability of its happening is, and always was, exceedingly low, although it did happen once.
Just as we did with the Goldilocks orbits, we can make the point that, however improbable the origin of life might be, we know it happened on Earth because we are here. Again, as with temperature, there are two hypotheses to explain what happened: the design hypothesis and the scientific or anthropic hypothesis. The design approach postulates a god who wrought a deliberate miracle, struck the prebiotic soup with divine fire, and launched DNA, or something equivalent, on its momentous career. Again, as with Goldilocks, the anthropic alternative to the design hypothesis is statistical. Scientists invoke the magic of large numbers. It has been estimated that there are between 1 billion and 30 billion planets in our galaxy, and about 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Knocking a few noughts off, for reasons of ordinary prudence, a billion billion is a conservative estimate of the number of available planets in the universe. Now, suppose the origin of life, the spontaneous arising of something equivalent to DNA, really was a quite staggeringly improbable event. Suppose it was so improbable as to occur on only one in a billion planets. A grant-giving body would laugh at any chemist who admitted that the chance of his proposed research succeeding was only 1 in 100, but here we are talking about odds of 1 in 1 billion. And yet, even with such absurdly long odds, life will still have arisen on a billion planets, of which Earth, of course, is one.
This conclusion is so surprising, I'll say it again. If the odds of life originating spontaneously on a planet were 1 billion to 1 against, nevertheless, that stupefyingly improbable event would still happen on 1 billion planets. The chance of finding any one of those billion life-bearing planets recalls the proverbial needle in a haystack. But we don't have to go out of our way to find a needle because, back to the anthropic principle, any beings capable of looking must necessarily be sitting on one of those prodigiously rare needles before they even start the search. My earlier calculation demonstrated that even a chemical model with odds of success as low as 1 in 1 billion would still predict that life would arise on 1 billion planets in the universe. And the beauty of the anthropic principle is that it tells us, against all intuition, that a chemical model need only predict that life will arise on one planet in 1 billion billion. To give us a good and entirely satisfying explanation for the presence of life here. I do not for a moment believe the origin of life was anywhere near so improbable in practice. I think it is definitely worth spending money on trying to duplicate the event in the lab, and by the same token on SETI, because I think it is likely that there is intelligent life elsewhere.
Even accepting the most pessimistic estimate of the probability that life might spontaneously originate, this statistical argument completely demolishes any suggestion that we should postulate design to fill the gap. Of all the apparent gaps in the evolutionary story, the origin of life gap can seem unbridgeable to brains calibrated to assess likelihood and risk on an everyday scale, the scale on which grant-giving bodies assess research proposals submitted by chemists. Yet even so big a gap as this is easily filled by statistically informed science, while the very same statistical science rules out a divine creator on the ultimate 747 grounds we met earlier.
But now, to return to the interesting point that launched this section. Suppose somebody tried to explain the general phenomenon of biological adaptation along the same lines as we have just applied to the origin of life, appealing to an immense number of available planets. The observed fact is that every species and every organ that has ever been looked at within every species is good at what it does. The wings of birds, bees, and bats are good at flying, eyes are good at seeing, leaves are good at photosynthesizing. We live on a planet where we are surrounded by perhaps 10 million species, each one of which independently displays a powerful illusion of apparent design. Each species is well fitted to its particular way of life. Could we get away with the huge numbers of planets argument to explain all these separate illusions of design? No, we could not. Repeat not. Don't even think about it. This is important, for it goes to the heart of the most serious misunderstanding of Darwinism. It doesn't matter how many planets we have to play with. Lucky chance could never be enough to explain the lush diversity of living complexity on Earth in the same way as we used it to explain the existence of life here in the first place. The evolution of life is a completely different case from the origin of life because, to repeat, the origin of life was, or could have been, a unique event which had to happen only once. The adaptive fit of species to their separate environments, on the other hand, is millionfold and ongoing.
It is clear that here on Earth we are dealing with a generalized process for optimizing biological species, a process that works all over the planet, on all continents and islands, and at all times. We can safely predict that if we wait another 10 million years, a whole new set of species will be as well adapted to their ways of life as today's species are to theirs. This is a recurrent, predictable, multiple phenomenon, not a piece of statistical luck recognized with hindsight. And thanks to Darwin, we know how it is brought about. By natural selection. The anthropic principle is impotent to explain the multifarious details of living creatures. We really need Darwin's powerful crane to account for the diversity of life on Earth, and especially the persuasive illusion of design. The origin of life, by contrast, lies outside the reach of that crane, because natural selection cannot proceed without it. Here the anthropic principle comes into its own. We can deal with the unique origin of life by postulating a very large number of planetary opportunities. Once that initial stroke of luck has been granted, and the anthropic principle most decisively grants it to us, natural selection takes over, and natural selection is emphatically not a matter of luck.
Nevertheless, it may be that the origin of life is not the only major gap in the evolutionary story that is bridged by sheer luck, anthropically justified. For example, my colleague Mark Ridley, in Mendel's Demon, has suggested that the origin of the eukaryotic cell, our kind of cell, with a nucleus and various other complicated features, such as mitochondria, which are not present in bacteria, was an even more momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable step than the origin of life. The origin of consciousness might be another major gap whose bridging was of the same order of improbability. One-off events like this might be explained by the anthropic principle along the following lines. There are billions of planets that have developed life at the level of bacteria, but only a fraction of these life forms ever made it across the gap to something like the eukaryotic cell. And of these, a yet smaller fraction managed to cross the later Rubicon to consciousness. If both of these are one-off events, we are not dealing with a ubiquitous and all-pervading process, as we are with ordinary, run-of-the-mill biological adaptation. The anthropic principle states that, since we are alive, eukaryotic, and conscious, our planet has to be one of the intensely rare planets that has bridged all three gaps.
Natural selection works because it is a cumulative one-way street to improvement. It needs some luck to get started, and the billions of planets' anthropic principle grants it that luck. Maybe a few later gaps in the evolutionary story also need major infusions of luck, with anthropic justification. But whatever else we may say, design certainly does not work as an explanation for life, because design is ultimately not cumulative, and it therefore raises bigger questions than it answers. It takes us straight back along the ultimate 747 infinite regress. We live on a planet that is friendly to our kind of life, and we have seen two reasons why this is so. One is that life has evolved to flourish in the conditions provided by the planet. This is because of natural selection. The other reason is the anthropic one. There are billions of planets in the universe, and however small the minority of evolution-friendly planets may be, our planet necessarily has to be one of them. Now it is time to take the anthropic principle back to an earlier stage, from biology back to cosmology. The anthropic principle, cosmological version. We live not only on a friendly planet, but also in a friendly universe. It follows from the fact of our existence that the laws of physics must be friendly enough to allow life to arise. It is no accident that when we look at the night sky, we see stars, for stars are a necessary prerequisite for the existence of most of the chemical elements, and without chemistry, there could be no life. Physicists have calculated that if the laws and constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been impossible. Different physicists put it in different ways, but the conclusion is always much the same. Martin Rees, in Just Six Numbers, lists six fundamental constants which are believed to hold all around the universe. Each of these six numbers is finely tuned, in the sense that if it were slightly different, the universe would be comprehensively different and presumably unfriendly to life.
We must say presumably, partly because we don't know how different alien forms of life might be, and partly because it is possible that we make a mistake if we consider only the consequences of changing one constant at a time. Could there be other combinations of values of the six numbers which would turn out to be friendly to life in ways that we do not discover if we consider them only one at a time?
An example of Rees's six numbers is the magnitude of the so-called strong force, the force that binds the components of an atomic nucleus, the nuclear force that has to be overcome when one splits the atom. It is measured as E, the proportion of the mass of a hydrogen nucleus that is converted to energy when hydrogen fuses to form helium. The value of this number in our universe is 0.007. And it looks as though it had to be very close to this value in order for any chemistry, which is a prerequisite for life, to exist. If the strong force were too small, say 0.006 instead of 0.007, the universe would contain nothing but hydrogen and no interesting chemistry could result. If it were too large, say 0.008, all the hydrogen would have fused to make heavier elements. A chemistry without hydrogen could not generate life as we know it. For one thing, there would be no water. The Goldilocks value, 0.007, is just right for yielding the richness of elements that we need for an interesting and life-supporting chemistry.
I won't go through the rest of Rees's six numbers. The bottom line for each of them is the same. The actual number sits in a Goldilocks band of values outside which life would not have been possible. How should we respond to this? Yet again, we have the theist answer on the one hand and the anthropic answer on the other. The theist says that God, when setting up the universe, tuned the fundamental constants of the universe so that each one lay in its Goldilocks zone for the production of life. It is as though God had six knobs that he could twiddle, and he carefully tuned each knob to its Goldilocks value. As ever, the theist answer is deeply unsatisfying because it leaves the existence of God unexplained. A God capable of calculating the Goldilocks values for the six numbers would have to be at least as improbable as the finely tuned combination of numbers itself, and that's very improbable indeed, which is indeed the premise of the whole discussion we are having. It follows that the theist answer has utterly failed to make any headway towards solving the problem at hand. I see no alternative but to dismiss it, while at the same time marvelling at the number of people who can't see the problem and seem genuinely satisfied by the divine knob-twiddler argument.
Biologists, with their raised consciousness of the power of natural selection to explain the rise of improbable things, are unlikely to be satisfied with any theory that evades the problem of improbability altogether. And the theistic response to the riddle of improbability is an evasion of stupendous proportions. It is more than a restatement of the problem, it is a grotesque amplification of it. Let's turn, then, to the anthropic alternative. The anthropic answer, in its most general form, is that we could only be discussing the question in the kind of universe that was capable of producing us. Our existence, therefore, determines that the fundamental constants of physics had to be in their respective Goldilocks zones. Different physicists espouse different kinds of anthropic solutions to the riddle of our existence. Hard-nosed physicists say that the six knobs were never free to vary in the first place. When we finally reach the long-hoped-for theory of everything, we shall see that the six key numbers depend upon each other, or on something else as yet unknown, in ways that we today cannot imagine. The six numbers may turn out to be no freer to vary than is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. It will turn out that there is only one way for a universe to be. Far from God being needed to twiddle six knobs, there are no knobs to twiddle.
Other physicists, Martin Rees himself would be an example, find this unsatisfying, and I think I agree with them. It is indeed perfectly plausible that there is only one way for a universe to be. But why did that one way have to be such a setup for our eventual evolution? Why did it have to be the kind of universe which seems almost as if, in the words of the theoretical physicist Freeman Dyson, it must have known we were coming? The philosopher John Leslie uses the analogy of a man sentenced to death by firing squad. It is just possible that all 10 men of the firing squad will miss their victim. With hindsight, the survivor, who finds himself in a position to reflect upon his luck, can cheerfully say, "Well, obviously they all missed, or I wouldn't be here thinking about it." But he could still, forgivably, wonder why they all missed, and toy with the hypothesis that they were bribed or drunk. This objection can be answered by the suggestion, which Martin Rees himself supports, that there are many universes coexisting like bubbles of foam in a multiverse or megaverse. The laws and constants of any one universe, such as our observable universe, are bylaws. The multiverse as a whole has a plethora of alternative sets of bylaws. The anthropic principle kicks in to explain that we have to be in one of those universes, presumably a minority, whose bylaws happen to be propitious to our eventual evolution and hence contemplation of the problem.
It is tempting to think, and many have succumbed, that to postulate a plethora of universes is a profligate luxury which should not be allowed. If we are going to permit the extravagance of a multiverse, so the argument runs, we might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb and allow a god. Aren't they both equally unparsimonious ad hoc hypotheses and equally unsatisfactory? People who think that have not had their consciousness raised by natural selection. The key difference between the genuinely extravagant God hypothesis and the apparently extravagant multiverse hypothesis is one of statistical improbability. The multiverse, for all that it is extravagant, is simple. God, or any intelligent, decision-taking, calculating agent, would have to be highly improbable in the very same statistical sense as the entities he is supposed to explain. The multiverse may seem extravagant in sheer number of universes, but if each one of those universes is simple in its fundamental laws, we are still not postulating anything highly improbable. The very opposite has to be said of any kind of intelligence.
An interlude at Cambridge. At a recent Cambridge conference on science and religion, where I put forward the argument I'm here calling the ultimate 747 argument, I encountered what, to say the least, was a cordial failure to achieve a meeting of minds on the question of God's simplicity. The experience was a revealing one, and I'd like to share it. I challenged the theologians to answer the point that a God capable of designing a universe, or anything else, would have to be complex and statistically improbable. The strongest response I heard was that I was brutally foisting a scientific epistemology upon an unwilling theology. Theologians had always defined God as simple. Who was I, a scientist, to dictate to theologians that their God had to be complex? Scientific arguments, such as those I was accustomed to deploying in my own field, were inappropriate, since theologians had always maintained that God lay outside science. I did not gain the impression that the theologians who mounted this evasive defence were being wilfully dishonest. I think they were sincere. Nevertheless, I was irresistibly reminded of Peter Medawar's comment on Father Teilhard de Chardin's The Phenomenon of Man, in the course of what is possibly the greatest negative book review of all time.
Its author can be excused of dishonesty only on the grounds that before deceiving others, he has taken great pains to deceive himself.
the theologians of my Cambridge encounter were defining themselves into an epistemological safe zone, where rational argument could not reach them because they had declared by fiat that it could not. Who was I to say that rational argument was the only admissible kind of argument? There are other ways of knowing besides the scientific, and it is one of these other ways of knowing that must be deployed to know God. The most important of these other ways of knowing turned out to be personal, subjective experience of God. Several discussants at Cambridge claimed that God spoke to them inside their heads, just as vividly and as personally as another human might. I have dealt with illusion and hallucination in Chapter 3, the argument from personal experience, but at the Cambridge conference I added 2 points. First, that if God really did communicate with humans, that fact would emphatically not lie outside science. God comes bursting through from whatever otherworldly domain is his natural abode, crashing through into our world where his messages can be intercepted by human brains. Has that phenomenon really nothing to do with science? Second, a God who is capable of sending intelligible signals to millions of people simultaneously and of receiving messages from all of them simultaneously cannot be, whatever else he might be, simple. Such bandwidth! God may not have a brain made of neurons or a CPU made of silicon, but if he has the powers attributed to him, he must have something far more elaborately and non-randomly constructed than the largest brain or the largest computer we know. Time and again my theologian friends returned to the point that there had to be a reason why there is something rather than nothing. There must have been a first cause of everything, and we might as well give it the name God. Yes, I said, but it must have been simple, and therefore whatever else we call it, God is not an appropriate name, unless we very explicitly divest it of all the baggage that the word God carries in the minds of most religious believers. The first cause that we seek must have been the simple basis for a self-bootstrapping crane, which eventually raised the world as we know it into its present complex existence. To suggest that the original prime mover was complicated enough to indulge in intelligent design, to say nothing of mind-reading millions of humans simultaneously, is tantamount to dealing yourself a perfect hand at bridge. Look around at the world of life, at the Amazon rainforest, with its rich interlacement of lianas, bromeliads, roots and flying buttresses, its army ants and its jaguars, its tapirs and peccaries, tree frogs and parrots. What you are looking at is the statistical equivalent of a perfect hand of cards. Think of all the other ways you could permute the parts, none of which would work. Except that we know how it came about, by the gradualistic crane of natural selection. It is not just scientists who revolt at mute acceptance of such improbability arising spontaneously. Common sense balks too. To suggest that the first cause, the great unknown which is responsible for something existing rather than nothing, is a being capable of designing the universe and of talking to a million people simultaneously, is a total abdication of the responsibility to find an explanation. It is a dreadful exhibition of self-indulgent, thought-denying skyhookery. I am not advocating some sort of narrowly scientistic way of thinking. But the very least that any honest quest for truth must have in setting out to explain such monstrosities of improbability as a rainforest, a coral reef, or a universe is a crane and not a skyhook. The crane doesn't have to be natural selection. Admittedly, nobody has ever thought of a better one, but there could be others yet to be discovered. Maybe the inflation that physicists postulate as occupying some fraction of the first yoctosecond of the universe's existence will turn out, when it is better understood, to be a cosmological crane to stand alongside Darwin's biological one. Or maybe the elusive crane that cosmologists seek will be a version of Darwin's idea itself. Or maybe it will be the multiverse plus anthropic principle espoused by Martin Rees and others. It may even be a superhuman designer, but if so, it will most certainly not be a designer who just popped into existence, or who always existed. If, which I don't believe for a moment, our universe was designed, and a fortiori, if the designer reads our thoughts and hands out omniscient advice, forgiveness and redemption, the designer himself must be the end product of some kind of cumulative escalator or crane, perhaps a version of Darwinism in another universe. The last-ditch defence by my critics at Cambridge was attack. My whole world view was condemned as 19th century. This is such a bad argument that I almost omitted to mention it, but regrettably I encounter it rather frequently. Needless to say, to call an argument 19th century is not the same as explaining what is wrong with it. Some 19th century ideas were very good ideas, not least Darwin's own dangerous idea. In any case, this particular piece of name-calling seemed a bit rich, coming as it did from an individual who justified his own Christian belief by invoking what he called the historicity of the New Testament. It was precisely in the 19th century that theologians, especially in Germany, called into grave doubt that alleged historicity, using the evidence-based methods of history to do so. This was, indeed, swiftly pointed out by the theologians at the Cambridge Conference. In any case, I know the 19th century taunt of old. It goes with the village atheist jibe. It goes with...
Contrary to what you seem to think, ha, 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 we don't believe in an old man with a long white beard any more. Ha, ha, ha.
All three jibes are code for something else. Just as when I lived in America in the late 1960s, law and order was politicians' code for anti-black prejudice. What, then, is the coded meaning of
"you are so 19th century"
in the context of an argument about religion? It is code for
"you are so crude and unsubtle. How could you be so insensitive and ill-mannered as to ask me a direct, point-blank question like, do you believe in miracles, or do you believe Jesus was born of a virgin? Don't you know that in polite society we don't ask such questions? That sort of question went out in the 19th century."
But think about why it is impolite to ask such direct, factual questions of religious people today. It is because it is embarrassing. But it is the answer that is embarrassing, if it is yes. The 19th century connection is now clear. The 19th century is the last time when it was possible for an educated person to admit to believing in miracles like the virgin birth without embarrassment. When pressed, many educated Christians today are too loyal to deny the virgin birth and the resurrection, but it embarrasses them because their rational minds know it is absurd, so they would much rather not be asked. Hence, if somebody like me insists on asking the question, it is I who am accused of being 19th century. It's really quite funny when you think about it. I left the conference stimulated and invigorated, and reinforced in my conviction that the argument from improbability, the ultimate 747 gambit, is a very serious argument against the existence of God, and one to which I have yet to hear a theologian give a convincing answer, despite numerous opportunities and invitations to do so. Dan Dennett rightly describes it as an unrebuttable refutation, as devastating today as when Philo used it to trounce Cleanthes in Hume's dialogues 2 centuries earlier. A skyhook would at best simply postpone the solution to the problem. But Hume couldn't think of any cranes, so he caved in. Darwin, of course, supplied the vital crane. How Hume would have loved it. If the argument of this chapter is accepted, the factual premise of religion, the God hypothesis, is untenable. God almost certainly does not exist. This is the main conclusion of the book so far. Various questions now follow, among them the moral questions. Doesn't religion motivate people to do good? If it weren't for religion, how would we know what is good?